Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host, researcher, minister, and friend, Charles Paisley, the founder of ChristianGospelChurch.org and the author of Come Out of Her, My People. Charles, it's good to be back and to talk about all things message-related and William Branham and Branhamism. And we're getting into the interesting part for me, the main sect. In the past few episodes, we've been examining all of the extremists. And I know we're going to catch some heat in the comment feeds and already in my email about, you guys are picking the most extreme cases. This is not a good representation of what the message stands for. But I'm always going to go back to Jesus said, you can tell the tree by the fruit that it bears, and that is the fruit of the message, whether you like it or not. And I'm also going to point to Dr. Stephen Hassan's book, Combating Cult Mind Control. If you understand how the mind control works, when you're indoctrinated in a cult that is training people that you must have a central figure, we always get the question, if not William Branham, who is our supreme leader? When you've been indoctrinated in that mindset and the leader dies, you're going to have people stepping up and claiming that they are the next thing closest to God. That's just how it works in a mind control cult. So even though the main sect may not, you know, propagate the same ideas as the extremists, what it does, it births new people who can become extremists later. So we're talking about the extremists that we've witnessed up to this point in time. There will be new extremists, and after that, there will be more new extremists, because it always goes back to, if the tree looks like this and it continues to bear the same fruit, it will always bear the same fruit, according to biblical scripture studies and according to even cult psychology studies. That's how this works. But now we're going to go and examine the trunk of this tree.
I look forward to that, John. Yeah, we're getting into some interesting stuff. And, you know, I have maybe a little bit of a different perspective, you know, having looked at all this a little bit. And, you know, people in the main sect, John, are really always keen to say, that's not us. We didn't have anything to do with that. That was these crazy people over here, right? But the truth is, every single group that we've talked about up to this stage, with like two very minor exceptions, are directly branched out of the main sect of the message. Every single one of them, okay? All branched out. The polygamists, the celibates, the crazies, every branch of it came out of the main sect. And it is dishonest, it's wicked, it's corrupt and deceitful for them to pretend that they have no connection or relationship. In fact, the truth is they are uniquely responsible for holding them all accountable, for doing stuff about it. And to me, it is incredibly telling, right, that the reaction of people in the main sect is always, wasn't us, right? No, not only was it them, right? Breakaways from them, they were uniquely responsible for holding those people accountable and bringing those situations under control. And they failed. They failed in their biblical responsibilities. They failed in their leadership abilities. I mean, it's absolutely all failures of the main sect that every one of these other splinter groups exist to begin with. And so, contrary to what they want to say, they are absolutely fully, wholly, and completely accountable for everything that has branched out of them. And it was their failure to have controls in place in the begin with to let it all happen. And so I have a very, very accountable view towards the main sect of the message, and then so forth, the others, of everything that's split out of them. Yeah. But you're right, John. We're going into the main sect of the message itself, okay? And I'm really looking forward to chatting about that. There's so much there. There's so much there for us to talk about, John. And I know you're from the main sect itself. And just for our listeners' sake, in case maybe today's the first time they're joining us, you're from the main sect. I'm from probably what is the first splinter group out of the main sect, which broke away in the 60s right after William Branham died. And so we're kind of exploring the sex of the message, and we've made it all our way finally to the granddaddy of them all, the main sect of the message.
And it's such a mess. I mean, there's so much to talk about. The thing I want to point out to further emphasize what you just said, yes, a lot of the extremists came out of the main sect. And I grew up in the main sect, so I watched this happen, and I'm unfortunately getting older in years, so I have seen things happen that many of the younger generation have not. But if you examine some of the more extreme leaders, those who were involved in financial scandals or those who went crazy with sexual stuff, there was a point in time in which they were well respected in the message among the leadership. And there were times when, you know, I've been in all kinds of different churches. I have seen numerous people who were traveling evangelists who would, they'd travel a circuit within the main sect, and you'd go visit this church that we used to go to in one of the cities and states that I lived in, and then they would go to this other one, and then this other one, and so they're traveling the circuit preaching, and they're lifted up as though they're this great spiritual figure because they're doing God's work. But then whenever they go extreme, which continues to be the case, some of them are just outright lambasted by the same people that invited them to the pulpit. That's the funny part. So there's this air of spiritual significance in the early part of their ministry whenever everybody's getting along. And then suddenly there are doctrines of demons coming out of them. But what's interesting about that is while they're on the in with the crowd, some of those doctrines of demons, as they call it, become integrated into message canon. Because the way that these people preach, if you're on the outside of this looking in, it's hard to understand this. When you think about preaching, you think about some man standing behind a pulpit and he's opening his Bible and let's talk about this passage from the book of John. And then you start making the Bible come alive to your listeners. Well, that's not the way it is in the main sect of the message. What it is, instead of the Bible, they will open up the Bible and they may read one verse or two. But I have seen countless ministers who, after they do this, they open up a message of William Branham in one of those little blue books, and they set it either beside or on top of the Bible. And I've heard the claim that it's like looking down the sights of a gun. You peer down the sights, and the hindsight that we have right here is the Bible. But you really need William Branham on that other sight. So the message, the spoken word, is the other sight to hit your target. And so what they do, they open up the Bible and it becomes secondary. Then they open up William Branham's sermons. And instead of making the Bible come alive, they try to make William Branham's sermons come alive. And they tell allegories and stories and their own supernatural experiences and their own experiences with William Branham, many of which aren't on any documentation anywhere else, but then those become part of the canon. And so those statements that they've made, which may or may not even be true, become accepted as part of the main sect theology.
I know just what you mean, John. I know just what you mean. And, you know, when you think about the main sect too, and I'll go so far as even to throw in most of the other sects with this, John. You know, there's a lot of people who say all this bad stuff happened, and you're correct. There are a lot of people who will blast their enemies from the platform, right? But are you aware, John? Are you aware of a single time when any message leader in the main sect or the others ever turned someone into the police for their thefts or their rapes or their molestations? Right, and so while we can say, right, and while, yeah, sure, you all can say, yeah, we blasted some of these guys from our platforms, what a absolute failure of a response. That is not the appropriate way to respond to these things, right? No, you should have called the police on these people. You should have turned them in, right? Over and over and over, right? And so, again, message leaders, and especially message leaders in the main sect, some of whom we're going to talk about, absolutely failed in their responsibilities, right, as just even decent moral human beings in a lot of cases for failing to turn in some of the stuff that happened, right? J.T. Parnell should have been called in on the police, right? You go on down the list, all these guys, a lot of them should have been called and turned into the police for what they were doing, right? Because there was a lot of really horrendous stuff that happened over the years. That's just one example. Gene and Leo, right? You can just go on down the list. Somebody should have called the police on these people, and they should have been locked up for what they were doing. Now, as we kind of break over and start talking about these guys, John, as we look at the main sect of the message, maybe I'll just start by recapping just a little bit of some of the stuff we've covered. through this period of time. So basically what I've been doing, John, I'm walking through my book, Come Out of Her, My People, Volume 2, and it goes all the way from 1966 to 2005. And I've kind of just been tracing the history of each of the major sects of the message through that period. And what you have is William Branham dies. We walked through how there was basically a hostile takeover of the message by Billy Paul shortly after William Branham died. Billy Paul was somebody, when William Branham died, he had a very poor reputation in the community. He was recently divorced and remarried, and that just brought a terrible repercussions with it, the way people looked at him. Besides that, you had Perry Green, who had just kind of showed up out of nowhere in the last year and a half before William Branham died and was kind of elbowing his way in. And the two of them together, John, the perspective of my sect of the message is they overthrew everybody else. They overthrew the Tabernacle Board. They overthrew the community out in Arizona through Perry Green, and basically set up shop over probably roughly half of the message at that point, maybe a little more than half. And as that happens, we talk through how the tape churches started to rise up in that period. And as the fight started to happen through that, you had a period of time where the preaching ministers in Jeffersonville tried to resist the takeover with Orman Neville and Raymond Jackson, different ones here. That all failed, and basically the tape churches got implemented starting here in Jeffersonville, as a way to more or less, the way again my sect of the message would look at it, to silence the preachers who were resisting Billy Paul, and that main sect takeover. And as your grandfather comes back here to Jeffersonville, and the tape church more or less becomes set in stone at the Branham Tabernacle, you start to see the come together, this accumulation of a number of other churches that start adopting the tape church model. And they form kind of the nucleus, and an important faction of the main sect of the message early on. Other really notable churches of that group were like Paul Brewer's church in Missouri, Earl and John Martin's church in Arkansas, Jack Palmer's church in Georgia. And you see a faction of churches come together that are very intent on playing tapes as the main part of their service. And what happens is, as time goes on, as the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and all of these schisms that we've been talking about, Estill Bieler breaks away, the Faith Assembly Fellowship breaks away, J.T. Parnell breaks away, the Paulazier Lowrys break away, the Parnells break away, Joseph Coleman breaks away with all their groups. Lee Vail breaks away with his groups. Ewald Frank breaks away with his groups. You just keep on going down that list. As all of that is happening, the percentage of churches in the main sect that have live preaching is shrinking, shrinking, shrinking. And the tape churches are becoming more and more the majority, because it's mainly the preaching churches that are leaving. And it's through this period of time that the control of message literature and control of all the recordings becomes very important to the central institutions. And as you come up into the 90s, late 80s and 90s, as the copyright wars unfold and as that last major schism really rocks the main sect of the message, you come out to the other side of that, probably by the mid to late 90s, where the tape churches are the majority of the main sect of the message. And so the first thing I wanted to point out was just that kind of that demographic shift that happens in the main sect over the decades. The natural result of a lot of the schisms is the tape churches rise to become the majority and the most influential portion in the main sect of the message.
I would agree with that. Most of the main sect churches that I visited, they either solely preach by playing the recordings of William Branham from 1947 to 1965, or they did this weird combination where they might preach on Sunday morning sometimes, and then Sunday evening, Wednesday night, and often services in between, they would be listening to these recordings and brainwashing the crowd. So I grew up like this. When you entered into the Branham Tabernacle, anybody who visited was a little shocked because they were all dressed up in their fancy clothes and they come and sat down and my grandfather would introduce the recording of William Branham and then say, "Hey, brother so-and-so, back in the tape room, press play on that tape." And they would press play and everybody would just sit there and calmly, quietly try to make it look like they were having some sort of spiritual excitement in this service, but they're sitting there and you can tell it on the kids' minds, man. They're bored out of their minds. My grandfather and the associate pastor were sitting on these big, large chairs on the platform, watching everybody listen to a tape. That's how this sermon went down, man. And as a kid, you're counting the number of holes in the ceiling tiles. And as you know, I've talked to some adults who, some of them are still in the message, but they said that, you know, it's just really hard in the Branham Tabernacle. You sit there and you're bored out of your mind because you've already listened to these recordings over and over in your own home. And then you go sit there and try to pretend like it's exciting. And I'm thinking about what restaurant are we going to after the service? That's a paraphrased actual quote from a guy who I think he's still in the message. But, that's wrong. That's the way that they're doing it. And it's wrong because not only are they trying to say that the statements made in the 40s, 50s, and 60s are good enough for today, and therefore we can listen to them, but people come to church looking for spiritual guidance. And the things happening during that era don't even closely resemble what is happening today. So all of the problems that people face today, they're left to face them alone. So when they enter these churches, there's just zero spiritual guidance. And if they try to get counsel from the ministers after the service or, you know, meeting in the homes or whatever, often the ministers in the main sect will point to the recordings and say things like, "Well, if it was good enough for back then, it's good enough for today. So just immerse yourself in the recordings, you'll get your answer." And they bypass the spiritual counsel altogether. So when you join one of these churches, you're basically, in a spiritual sense, you're in this spiritual desert. There is nothing for you.
Well, those are some great observations, John. And I think that that's very true, very true. I know in the churches I come from, like they and most of the other sects of the message, the fact that the main sect plays tapes rather than has consistent live preaching is generally a massive point of contention today between the main sect. And it's really always been a contention, really from day one when they started doing it. I know a lot of the preachers in the other sects of the message, they view the pressure to establish a tape church or convert to a tape church, they view that as a more or less an attempt by the main sect to shut them up, basically. And that, I have to say, in my opinion, that probably did play a major role. I really think that is a substantial part of the leadership of the main sect. I think that's absolutely in their thinking, is it's not, you know, press play, it's shut up and press play. Like, I think you could add the word shut up in front of the press play and you would be getting the emphasis probably just as accurate from what the leaders in the main sect want. We don't want to hear what you have to say, shut up, press play, right? And that is how a lot of the other sects of the message, they hear the word shut up before press play from the main sect. But I think the viewpoint in the main sect, though, to be fair, is different. I think the average rank and file don't look at it that way. I think the average rank and file looks at it as, and I believe I've heard this articulated more or less directly, William Branham brought the perfect revelation. The perfect has come. Why do we need a middleman? Let's just press play and get the perfect from the source. And that is, I believe, the official rationale as to why tapes are played. I don't know, John, was it ever explained why we play tapes as opposed to, you know, have a preacher preach a sermon? Like, do you know an official explanation for that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to and where you were at the time. I remember that there was this guy who wasn't even a parishioner of the Branham Tabernacle, but he would often frequently come to the Tabernacle, and he would get forcibly ejected from the meetings, and he would, I'm told, I wasn't there to witness this, but I'm told by multiple family members and multiple deacons that, and sometimes it actually broke out into a fist fight. The guy was, he had a temper. The funny part is he was a really close friend of the family. I wish I could say who he was, but anyway, this guy was a fighter, and the reason he was forcibly ejected is because the Branham Tabernacle was already a tape church. You came dressed in your Sunday school clothes and you sat down and sat bored for, these tapes aren't short. They're sometimes 2.5 hours long. Well, so you're sitting there.
Some over 3 1 hours even.
Yeah, some over three. Gracious. I mean, this is, it is torture. It is torture to do this, right? And this guy's screaming like a Nazi through these recordings. People on the outside of this message cult have no idea what this is like. But anyway, this guy came to these services. My grandfather would, I'm using the word loosely, preach Sunday school, which usually consisted of him telling stories of his wonderful experiences with William Branham. And he would open with a Bible verse. And I think most times, if I recall correctly, we would, as a congregation, read a psalm together. But then he would tell these spiritual experiences, which are, me and Brother Branham were going down the road one day and we saw a coffee shop and we stopped and he told me the most wonderful thing. That's how my grandfather would do. And it would always point back to the Bible verse. So it was like the sermon wasn't even about the Bible. It was about this thing that happened to him and he saw how it connected to the Bible. That's probably the easiest and best way I can say it. Well, this guy would come in and he would hear my grandfather doing this, and he wanted nothing but the recordings. He thought it was complete heresy for anybody who is a minister to preach, because by William Branham's own words, the message and the messenger are one and the same. If you add another person to this mix, you have a different messenger. He was actually more closely aligned to the message than the message cult itself. And he wanted my grandfather to shut up. So the shut up phrase that you're using, that's what he did. Well, he would create such a ruckus, they would have to forcibly eject him, and it would come to fist fights. So if you ask him, the reason why people play tapes is solely because of what William Branham said. The message and the messenger are one and the same. You can't have another messenger. Otherwise, look at the extremists that we have. Their message has become one and the same with them, and they're isolated from the other group. So in this guy's mind, my grandfather was trying to rise up to be another replacement of William Branham by speaking. So in his eyes, that's what it was. On the flip side, you had all of these people who, the spiritual counsel, I can't stress that enough, the way in which they wanted you to find any comfort for whatever it is, if you have sin in your life, you go to the recordings. If you're seeking healing, you go to the recordings. No matter what it is in your life, you go to the recordings. I have, and this is common, I don't think anybody who is out there would object to this. If I were to be diagnosed with some, I don't know, kidney disease, and suddenly, by happenstance, magically listen to a recording and catch that somebody in a prayer line had that same kidney disease, well, William Branham wasn't speaking just to them. He's also speaking to me, even though that recording was 1950s, whatever it is. And they accept their healing based on William Branham claiming to have healed another person, not knowing that that person may have died of that same disease. But that's how it works in the main sect. So some people you ask, it's because they're, you know, the message and the messenger are the same. Other people, it's because that is where you go for everything that you need, spiritually speaking.
That is really fascinating, John. Very interesting. Very interesting. You know, the main sect of the message, listen to the tapes, like, I can understand their rationale, you know, in some extent, because, you know, the things that William Branham said, the sects of the message, like, that I come from, or, you know, that are similar, they are more latter rain oriented in their model, where they're more interested in the fivefold ministry stuff still too, right? And they take the latter rain verses that you need the, what they would call the fivefold ministry, for the perfecting of the saints. And so they fit this They fit a continuation of preaching and a continuation of preachers into the necessity to reach manifested sons of God. And so you have to think all of these sects are obsessed with manifested sons of God, right? And so I think in part what we're talking about here is a difference of opinion about how to get there. You know, the main sect thinks we're going to get there through the tapes because we've got the perfect. But the other sects that still embrace preaching, you know, they take the fivefold ministry verses and say, well, we also still need a preaching ministry to get to the perfecting of the saints. So you have this at a doctrinal level in the teachings, you have this fight between the two sects, right? And it comes back to their different interpretations of the message as well. One side perhaps being still a little bit more leaning towards the original latter rain teachings. It's fascinating, isn't it, John?
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So I'm going to open up and I'm going to tell a story that I've never told on here. All of the parties involved are dead. So I can tell it now. I withhold things because I don't want to, they're family. I don't want to mess things up. But there is a common problem among message leadership of seared consciences. They have no conscience whatsoever when they speak. If I'm speaking in a podcast to you, Charles, and I say something that after I say it, you're in the heat of the moment and you make mistakes. After I say it, if I realize that I said something wrong, it bothers me. Like I will immediately, people don't know this listening to the podcast, we'll go back sometimes and correct some of the statements that we make. That's how it is, because in the back of my head, I can't sit still. If I've done something wrong, I want the people to know I've done something wrong. And so I want to correct it before it gets out. But message leadership, it's not that way. They see, there's a Gnostic view of lies for the sake of a holy end, and I think they go down that pathway a lot. But anyway, I had this experience with a family member, and it was edging very, very close to voodoo and witch doctors kind of thing, which sounds funny if you're thinking in the context of Christianity. Picture the scene where you go into some tribe in the middle of nowhere in Africa, and somebody has just become severely injured and may die. And you walk into the hut, and there's all of this incense floating around in the air, and they're chanting and doing all kinds of things, rituals that, you know, from our perspective in the modern world, we look at this and we think, well, that chanting is not going to heal this person who's dying or whatever it is. That's what's happening in these camps in the middle of nowhere, right? In these developing nations. Well, I walked into a hospital room and the same exact thing was happening. I have a family member who made national news when he blew up his meth lab in his house and nearly took out a fireman with him. His house exploded. He was burned. Over 50% of his body was burned. His flesh on his arms and legs had become tourniquets. And when I walked into the hospital room, they had actually filleted his arms and legs to make it where he wasn't going to lose his limbs. That's how bad it was. And I walk in and it was the most disgusting, horrific thing I've ever seen. He was, you know, he usually was tanned, but he was as black as, he looked like you pull a log out of the fireplace. That's how he looked. My grandfather from behind the pulpit said, now I want you to pray for, and I'm not going to give the relationship, I want you to pray for brother so-and-so. He got in a motorcycle wreck. And so everybody's praying for this motorcycle wreck that didn't happen. I go to the hospital and he was registered under some weird name like Tom Jones or something that wasn't his name. And I walk into the hospital room, and the way that they were administering healing, because they did not trust that the hospital could heal him, was they were playing the recordings of William Branham 24/7. They were sitting watch with him. When the tape would stop, there was somebody in the room to flip the tapes, because they thought that he would receive his healing by listening to those recordings. It was an enchantment of sorts. And you can picture what the nurses and doctors thought. They're walking in, and here's this guy screaming like a Nazi in the, in the speakers of this tape player that they brought in. Well, whether it worked or not, my family would say it worked, because he did recover and blew up his meth lab house a second time. And in the second instance, my grandfather got behind the pulpit and he said something to the effect of, "Please pray for brother so-and-so. He was messing with gasoline and he had a serious accident." But his meth lab exploded. He goes back in the hospital. They did the same exact thing. Now, my family will argue that this second attempt at voodoo worked, because he did recover again, later to die of something else. So that's how this works if you think about these recordings. It is such a weird, weird mess that it doesn't even resemble Christianity whatsoever.
Wow, John, that's an awful story. And it is illustrative of just how message leaders will bend the facts and the truth and really just be outright dishonest in order to kind of present a false narrative. And it's also really illustrative of how the main sect views the tapes with these magical healing powers in the words of the prophet. That's very interesting, John. Very interesting. Now, I think the next thing to point out about the main sect is the leadership of it. You know, I mentioned how when William Branham died, Billy Paul basically overthrew the Branham Tabernacle and put himself into power. He did that with help from Perry Green and people coming back from the Tucson message community. So they brought a bunch of people back from Tucson. They had a more or less secret election at the Tabernacle, an impromptu service where he brought a bunch of people from Deity Cult especially back and voted him in as pastor and general overseer, really, of the Branham Tabernacle. That all preceded your grandfather coming back. He was out in Arizona still at that time as well. And the reason that he was able to get away with that, John, over the protests of the majority of the Jeffersonville message community, was that the Deity Cult controlled the majority of the trustee positions on the boards of the central institutions of the message. Now, in our next episode, I hope we're going to start actually talking about the central institutions themselves and the board members and just the history of some of that, how that all came together and evolved. But basically, before William Branham died, he put the Deity Cult in control of the central institutions of the message. And now the message has four central institutions, John, and what I consider central institutions. And those central institutions, John, that's really how I define the main sect of the message. You know, other people might define it. You might even have a little different definition than me. But the way that I define the main sect of the message is the main sect of the message is the four central institutions and all of the people who are loyal and cooperate with those institutions. And if you think of the central institutions of the message like a pyramid, the top of the pyramid is the William Branham Evangelistic Association. That's the top of the pyramid. It, back in the early days, it controlled all of the intellectual property. It owned the copyrights. It was the controlling institution. It was established in 1965. It was actually established in November or December of 1965 under somewhat mysterious circumstances. We'll discuss in our next episode. But it was established. Billy Paul was on that board along with two members of the Deity Cult, Fred Softman, Roy Roberson. They were the founding members of the William Branham Evangelistic Association. Later on, Fred Softman got on the board as well. And they are basically the guys who control the top. So it's Billy Paul and two or three guys who think he is the son of God. that is who controlled the William Branham Evangelistic Association. The same down at the Branham Tabernacle, the majority of the board there was all deity cult, all put in place by William Branham. And the same thing when Billy Paul had the corrupt election and got himself put in as general overseer there. The board was controlled by the deity cult. They did not want to dislodge him, and so he was allowed to continue in that position. And he essentially is who appointed your grandfather in as a pastor, and Vernon Mann and the others that came along through before. So Billy Paul was always kind of the secret power in all of these things. Besides that, there's two other central institutions. So I said the WBEA and the Branham Tabernacle. Well, the Branham Tabernacle controls all the assets of the local Jeffersonville message community. Or at least they did until somebody stole it all from them. Maybe we'll talk about that too later. and so you had that. And then you had the other two central institutions. One of them is, you'll hear me call it the franchise that turned into Voice of God Recordings and the franchise that turned into Spoken Word Publications. I phrase it like that because they were not always called Voice of God and Spoken Word. They started out and things changed over the years, but they're most commonly and fondly remembered as Spoken Word and Voice of God. So the franchise that became Spoken Word, the franchise that became Voice of God, those were the other two central institutions. And those were kind of like mission arms of the message. Spoken Word Publications was creating print literature, that franchise, which pre-existed and continued on after. And then the franchise which became Voice of God Recordings was the franchise creating all of the actual recordings. And in our next episode, we'll just talk through the evolution of who was involved in all that and just connect up the dots for everybody, because I do think it's going to help people just to understand how all that evolved over the years. But in a nutshell, Fred Sothman, who is also on the WBA, he is the director of the franchise that becomes Voice of God Recordings. And Roy Borders is the director of the franchise that becomes Spoken Word Publications, okay? And so all of these guys, basically all of the directors and board members are shared across all these groups is what I'm getting at. It's the same leadership team, more or less, across all the groups with different levels of say. And so those are the central institutions. Those are the key guys. And my chief point here is, one, they're really all controlled by the same group of friends. Besides Billy Paul, they were all in the deity cult when all of this stuff started out. They were all deity cult members, okay? Joseph was not involved in this when he was back then. Joseph was a child still, minor, when his father passed away. So Joseph didn't get involved into this till years later. But it was all the deity cult, and it was Billy Paul really in the controlling position through the years. And Billy Paul kind of managed it. I'm going to say he managed it all with mostly with soft power. I think that'd be a fair way to put it, wouldn't it be, John? And I think that Billy Paul, I don't know maybe that he necessarily knew this from the start, but certainly he came to realize this very quickly after the hostile takeover of the Branham Tabernacle and all the pushback he came. His hold on power was always somewhat fragile. And holding the whole central, the main sect together, it was always a fragile thing, right? Because everybody is ready to jump on each other and call each other a heretic and schism at any second over anything, okay? And Billy Paul, in one sense, they're trying to hold it together, right? And so Billy Paul is, besides the initial hostile takeover, he kind of transitions into this gentle leadership style. I think that's a nice way to put it. And he only used the hard power when it was a matter of not, you know, if something happened and he was threatened, then the claws had to come out. But so long as, you know, the soft power worked, right, you would not have necessarily realized Billy Paul is the cult leader of the main sect of the message. He was just kind of this passive, let everybody else do everything. And so long as I am in the general overseer chair, and long as I am in the chairman chair, and as long as I am in the treasurer chair, okay, everybody else, you do what you want, and I'm going to be gentle and kind and nice, but don't get on my bad side or threaten my position, because then the claws will come out. That was Billy Paul's leadership style.
I have another term for it. You know, Charles, we're going to have to come up with our own set of terms, because we're edging very close to the point where some of the people are still alive and have mountains of money to issue lawsuits. So I think what I'm going to do, people who are in the message will understand this term, and people on the outside may not get it, but it sort of puts up a legal barrier between us. But I'm going to start using the term Prophet Junior for some of the things that we're going to say in these upcoming episodes. If you're from the message, you know exactly who Prophet Junior is. But I have a different term than you used. I consider this to be more of a Penn and Teller show. If you understand the comedian act of Penn and Teller, there's this boisterous guy, he's a very tall, big, hefty guy, very boisterous personality, and he is the face of the comedy act. He's the one doing all the speaking. His partner has he's almost mute. I don't know that he ever speaks, but he just sits there and he smiles and makes faces and expressions while the boisterous guy is making all the jokes. But it's the silent guy who's actually the brains behind the act. So it's a Penn and Teller show. If you look at Billy Paul, he, like you said, he was this friendly, timid guy that would never do many of the things that Prophet Junior and some of the others are doing. But the Penn and Teller act is, it's all throughout the message. If you were on the inside and you understood the dynamics of how this worked, there was a brains behind the operation and there was a face behind the operation.
That's very true. And they weren't the same person. And so definitely the way I characterize it is, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Billy Paul was the man with his hands on all the levers of power across the main sect of the message. He was in control of all of the central institutions. No questions asked. But the people running it were the faces, okay? Fred Softman was the face. Boy, what a silly face to choose. Fred Softman was one face, right? Roy Borders was another face, right? Your grandfather was a face. And Roy Roberson, even to some extent, was a face. So Billy Paul has these other guys who are out front, right? And he's more or less in the back room making the decisions and giving, you know, instructions and stuff. And so long as the money is flowing, that's my take. So long as the money's flowing, so long as everything's moving on, Billy Paul really don't care too much, right? And for me, John, now this is another just opinion. This goes back to me. I don't think Billy Paul ever believed the message, right? Because the lack of passion, the lack of getting into all of the fights and all of the schisms. John, are you aware of any single real message believer that doesn't have incredibly strong opinions that they would fight to the death over? Are you aware of such a message believer as that?
None. There is no way, man.
So the fact that somebody could be in the message all of those years and never have a serious conviction enough that they would get into a fight on a schism over is a pretty good sign that they don't really believe the message. Because for the average message believer, these things are life and death struggles. You know, go to the firing squad to fight over this. You know, you will do anything to be on the right side and win and make it in the rapture. You know, William Branham would say, if there's only one person in Jeffersonville gonna make it, it's gonna be me, you know? And that's you ever heard people in the message say that, John? And that is the attitude of a lot of people. If anybody here is gonna make it, you better believe it's gonna be me. And, you know, and they will whatever it takes to make sure they are the one person that makes it. And the fact that Billy Paul never got into any of that, to me, is very telling that he was aware of what it all was, right? And he was just happy to collect the check in the back room while everyone else was crazy.
Well, and the funny part about all of that is there were people who knew Billy Paul growing up and knew the way that he acted, the things that he did while William Branham was preaching, some of the things that he did outside of the building. And they would argue that, he never believed it because he never lived it. He didn't have the lifestyle. And what's funny, many of those same people would say that even while I was in the message, and they didn't know the lifestyle of Prophet Junior. And so they thought that they were two different people with two different personalities, both of which believed the message. My family, even while before any of this happened, before any of my research, they weren't fully sold on the idea that one or two or both of the brothers truly believed the message at all, because they just didn't act like other message believers.
Prophet Jr. is an interesting case, and his rise into power, John, really comes very close to the end of my book. So, so we might not have to say a whole lot about that. But yes, there's just a very interesting contrast between the way Billy Paul and his successor manage things. I think Billy Paul had an understanding of the fragility of the situation, and he also had a more honest understanding of just how this whole thing works and how it's held together, right? And you lost that during the transition in leadership, and that then you have somebody with someone who's not up to the task in some sense. Okay, being generous here, someone who's maybe not quite up to the task of holding such a diverse, complex thing together, and ends up causing the major schisms, some of them that happened in the 90s and early 2000s. Okay, so yeah, I mean, I think just that difference in leadership style explains a lot of what transpired as Billy Paul went into retirement. So, but for the main portion of my book, Billy Paul is the guy running the main sect of the message, and a lot of what we're going to talk about, through the next few episodes is the period of time where Billy Paul's in charge. What happens is, as you come into the early to mid 90s, Billy Paul does start grooming his successor, and in the early 2000s, Billy Paul starts to go into semi-retirement and turn things over to his successor. And we might talk about his successor some more down the road. But definitely for the point and period they're recovering, it's really important to know the churches of the main sect are gradually becoming increasingly tape churches, less and less preaching churches. The central institutions are controlled by Billy Paul and the Deity cult. And if we haven't said again who the Deity cult is, again, maybe this is someone's first time joining us. The Deity cult is the section of the main sect which worships William Branham as God incarnate. They baptize, they pray in his name, they say he is God in the flesh, okay? The Deity cult, they are the ones in charge. And John, that is so important to point out to people. It is so absolutely important for all of the people in the message and outside the message to know the central institutions of the message are controlled and have been since their inception by the members of the Branham Deity cult. They are the Deity cult. And what's important is even more than knowing that they're controlled by the Deity cult, it's important to know William Branham is the one who put the Deity cult in power. Okay. William Branham, very famously, we did a full episode on the bruised serpent, if you want to look it up through the past. The bruised serpent episode, William Branham preached a sermon called The Bruised Serpent, where he, on tape, he condemned the Deity cult. He condemned the people who worship and pray in his name and says, "You can't do that anymore. No, that's bad." And then less than a year later, he takes those same people and he makes them trustees and directors and senior leaders over the key institutions of the message. Okay? That is absolutely what happened. And the way that I interpret it, John, is that he was just doing damage control with the bruised serpent sermon. That was just a damage control sermon because the Deity cult had got caught and he had to confront them in order to save himself at that point. And then after things quieted down a little bit, he took the Deity cult and he moved with them to Arizona and he put them in charge of all the central institutions of the message. And they still worshiped him as God and baptized in his name. And he knew it the whole time. He knew when he moved out. There's all kinds of records that he knew that they were the Deity cult, that they were worshiping him. And he chose to put them in control of the central institutions. And so throughout this entire period, while the rank and file person in the main sect does not believe William Branham was God incarnate, absolutely not, the leaders of the main sect and its central institutions were absolutely members of the Deity cult. Absolutely.
I would agree with that. And the funny part is, not many people who are even in the main sect realize this. You and I have, even before this one, we had some discussions about what was true and what was not concerning the leadership of the Branham Tabernacle and its main sect establishments. Key figures who were truly believers that William Branham was God in the flesh were appointed to very critical positions of leadership. And I had no idea that these men were on even legal documents. Some of the legal documents have them in it because we saw them as nut jobs. Fred Southman, that guy was crazy, man. Anybody who knew him knew that he was crazy. There's this video that I think we played a few clips from where he's talking about how William Branham was greater than Jesus, and Jesus could never do the same miracles that William Branham did. He was so much greater and more powerful. And the backstory behind that, people would go visit Fred Sothman because he would say the craziest things. And if you could get him on recording, it made a good laugh. I don't know if that was one of them. Maybe the people believe what he was saying. I don't know. But anybody of any sound mind listening to it would realize that that guy has lost his mental faculties. And no, William Branham was not God in the flesh. But the fact that he and many, many others were put in leadership positions solely because they believed that William Branham was God is very telling.
You are correct. And you can go down the list of every trustee of the central institutions, and every last one of them is on recording somewhere saying William Branham is God in the flesh. Every last one of them. And I document those in the book if people want some footnotes and stuff to chase all those down, the first and second volume of Message History, but every last one of them, right? And so it's not even in dispute that that is what they believe. That is absolutely what they believe. And so this thing is always this weird abomination from day one, John. I mean, it is from the moment William Branham dies. I mean, it just becomes an increasingly worse abomination. You know, you've got Billy Paul, who probably doesn't believe the message, running the central institutions, which were led by people who think that William Branham was God incarnate. And they are the ones propagating all of the tapes and all of the literature and going on, you know. And it's just, you know, what do you do with that? It's so strange on one hand, but then on the other hand, it's just so ugly. This, you know, it's just abominable, the whole thing, John. Abominable. And lots of people did know it. There's a lot of people that did know it. Like, the people in my sect, a lot of them left over it, you know, back in the day when it all started. But there's been lots of people that know those things. But where can you go, John? You think me and you are doing this here in the year 2025, right? And we record these a few weeks in advance, so, you know. This will come out later this year, but where can we go? Just think, the whole world, of all the mess, where can we go and find anyone in the message saying, hey guys, Fred Sothman and these guys are all in the DD cult? Where is anybody warning people? Where is anybody out there for all the Message History putting this out there for people to hear? It's not really there, is it? It's not really there. You know, if you were in the circles of leadership here in Jeffersonville, you probably know about it. If you came to my church and were there when Raymond Jackson preached about it a few times and gave out everybody's names and played some like, you would know about it. But otherwise, there's very little awareness outside of the core leaders of the message that this is even a reality.
Well, there's so much to talk about. I think if we start another subject, some of the subjects that we have are so big, it would probably require an entire podcast. So maybe we'll cut off here. But getting into some of the other things that we have spoken about, Gene and Leo and their torture compound in Prescott, Arizona, many of the things like this are a direct result of the main sect of the message. So you can't have a extremist who is preying upon others. I'll say it lightly so that YouTube doesn't block us. You can't have that without a main sect. From the tree produces the fruit. That's how this works. If you know the Bible, you know that what I'm saying is biblically accurate. You examine the tree by its fruit. So the further we go in this tree, you'll understand that even while the main sect would say that the tree trunk, the main sect, is holy, and that all of these extremists that blossomed from that tree, they're just rogue agents for Satan. They're working their way into heresy. And William Branham never condoned that. You're going to find that William Branham actually established his main sect from that structure. He wanted the extremists. He wanted the people that believed that he was God. And then after he died, and the leadership that already was somewhat this weird mess of deity cult, they wanted more people of extreme nature. So they're bringing in more messed up people to help lead this thing. And that is what grew the tree that blossomed into all of this fruit that we see. So much more I can say, but maybe next time we'll get into some of the deeper, darker secrets of the main sect.
I'm looking forward to it, John. We have got to walk through the history of the central institutions, and there are some things in there that I just don't think people have connected the dots, and I'm going to connect the dots for you, ladies and gentlemen. You come back next time, and we'll show you some interesting stuff.
Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org and christiangospelchurch.org. For more about William Branham and the healing revivals, you can read Come Out of Her, My People. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, both available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.